This is a production of Cornell University.
EA meeting April 18th, 2007.
Everyone's going to be running a little bit late today. So we'll just start in our regular agenda and suspend it when she comes to go back to what we were going to discuss.
Where she came from.
With her. Michael reported that he wasn't going to be here today, so there won't be any questions report. The meetings. There were meetings last week, I think. But Michael didn't attend those. It was finance and audit. Trustee task force on comprehensive master plan. The executive committee, not as far as I know, everything went swimmingly. So if I didn't hear anything, yeah. Okay. So can we have a call to order? I'm going to start the meeting. Any late additions to the agenda? Mm-hmm. Okay. Subject that would consist of the business of the day. Report from chair. I'll come back if you have a chance to do that. I'll come back. So Amy sent out minutes for January 3rd and March 7th. I don't know if anyone has had a chance to review them. I know. So I'll count on you to let me know if there are any changes. Has anyone had a chance to review them?
No.
Okay, so I'm not the only one. All right.
No.
I was kind of in meetings on when I didn't know when they came. Okay. So January 3rd or March 7th. So should we just suspend approval of these until the next meeting?
Yes.
So you have time to review? Okay, I think so too. All right, so we'll do that in the next meeting. Wow, we're just moving right through the agenda. Old business, our friend Ms. Mahoney, who is our representative on the Inclement Weather Committee, is here to report to us about their first meeting.
Yes, and it was actually a very good
meeting.
During
inclement weather.
During inclement weather as well. The group that was there, the representatives were generally academic, which I was kind of surprised about a little bit. But, and, of course, Thomas Bruce, or whatever, Tom? Bruce? Thomas? Okay. He was there as well. The group really had some paperwork to look at. There were all of the suggestions, the comments, recommendations that were given by staff and faculty, those who were interested in responding to the blog that Tommy had sent out. All of that information was taken and gathered and put into a specific document that they shared with us to take a look at. Very, very well received, all of the comments. Not so much what went wrong, but what we could do better next time. And I think that the group was very receptive to every one of those comments. There were a few suggestions that came from that. And one was that there apparently is another, there are actually two other groups on campus right now that are working on this same type of a situation. One is CIT, and they are talking about in the event of an emergency, not just inclement weather, but in an emergency, having an email system that is going to fly out to students, faculty, staff, etc., to alert them of that, whatever that issue is. They were not aware that this other committee was also working on a phone system, some software that would be somehow purchased to attach to the phone system so that simultaneous phone calls would go out to departments, units, students, faculty, whomever. So once we found out that those two groups were actually working on this, they agreed that they were going to share their information with our group as well. So we kind of got this whole mishmash of different pieces, and we're pulling it all together. I'm not sure that the Inclement Weather Committee is going to be the source of getting this information out, but at least we all know each other exists out there. So we're working very closely now to get this information out and to kind of review everything that's available to us. We are going to meet again. We haven't set the date yet. We're waiting for the chair of the emergency group, Rich. I can't remember his last name. McDaniel, thank you. He will be getting us scheduled for the next meeting. But I felt very comfortable at the meeting. I was heard. I was allowed to speak freely. I didn't feel as though there were any restrictions placed on me as a staff member or as a representative of the EA. And they welcomed my comments. And I also represented Geneva. So I kind of did a twofold function at this meeting, and I felt that that was a good thing as well. So I'm excited. I'm happy. I think that this group is going to do a really good job, and I'm hoping when it's all said and done that the information we have, what we can decipher, what we can review, will help to change the inclement weather policy.
So maybe it's too early to ask this question, but you were talking about like a phone tree and that mm-hmm. sort of stuff. So I'm envisioning, you know, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday morning and the snow is falling. How am I going to get a phone call? Should I call into Audix to see if there's a mess? I mean, how does that, I just mechanically, how does that work?
Well, I can answer that question because I was involved with the Sunday through Tuesday things that we were dealing with this week. But I guess I was actually, as a follow-up to that, interested in feedback from this group that I might carry forward. I had some concerns last Friday that we hadn't solved some of the problems that were out there. So how did you all think this Sunday through Thursday, or Sunday through Tuesday that we just experienced with the potential for problems, how do you think that went? Were you aware of communications or not, or what?
Well, at home, I kept checking my computer early in the morning, but everybody might not have access. Mm-hmm. And also my phone system, although I have a cell phone, but my other phone, if the power goes out, that phone goes out. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how a phone tree would work if phones go out, or people don't have computers or cell phones. Mm-hmm.
So you were checking Cornell.edu?
Yes.
Something like that?
Me too.
And also, Peggy, just to kind of add on to what you were saying, that is one topic that we discussed. They are, Marilyn Cummings from, she's Facilities for Cal, she actually is leading this group to review and research the phone vendors that could actually provide software that will accommodate this. We don't have all the answers yet, and we're certainly not sure how this would work or if it would work, but they are tasked right now with doing this research, finding some vendors, sending a request for proposal out to several to have them come back with a plan, with something that will tell us this is what will work.
These are individual cell phones that you're talking about, right?
No. This is a centralized system that will go through the university that once that call has been made by Steve or whomever is going to make that call, that goes into this phone system, and it's actually phone software. Once that call or that prompt is given to that phone system, that will then generate that phone to start making phone calls. It's a long and tedious process to get this information into this software.
Okay, because Mary was explaining something to me regarding the possibility of purchasing software that then individual owners of cell phones could subscribe to and then get the messages on their cell phone.
Wow. That never came up during this meeting.
Okay.
And that
technology is out there actually right now.
So
I think it's a push or a pull and whether it's going and how it goes out and to what number and whether it's a subscription thing or not are a lot of questions I think that need answering. So. I know that through this thing, folks were very aware of keeping updated messages so that at 8 p.m. or at 4:30 p.m. or at 12 noon, when decisions had been made, it was as of 4 p.m. today or 8 a.m. whatever, that this is the situation, and also keeping things consistent with what was on Cornell.edu, what was on CU Info, what was on the 254 message, what was on the 3377, which is the inclement weather line, by the way, 255-3377, it's the Cornell Police line. So there was a lot of recognition of keeping all of that consistent. Mm-hmm.
And outside of the phone system as well, there were other comments that Steve made, and based on a lot of this information that we gathered, that was gathered, it's basically use your head. If the roads are bad, if the roads are closed, you just don't come in. You will deal with that after, but you just don't take your life into your hands. If you're not comfortable driving, don't drive. So we need to be smart enough to know that ourselves. And the second part of that also is departments and units need to be aware of who their essential personnel are. So you need to get that list in order. Every department should have a complete and accurate list of who their essential personnel are. So those are the people that are going to be traveling the roads, not anybody and everybody, but those who they feel once the university is closed have to be there, because you can never close. That is the list that we need to get more aware of, and we've got to prompt and encourage departments and units to do that.
Mm-hmm. I would guess, although I haven't heard or seen on TV, but does Cornell also plug into the media, the radio shows and the TV?
Yes.
Because I saw these Syracuse go or Trumansburg is closed.
Well,
does Cornell also do
yes,
that?
Yes, they do, if they're closed or if they have a delayed opening.
Okay.
And that's all done through the press office, Simeon Moss's shop.
Okay.
And he gets plugged into that if the decision is made to close.
Fine.
I know that. But you're right, technology's out there, it's been out there, but even text messages, is that what you're talking about, just getting a text message and it totally overflows?
No, that's not, I don't know what the vendors have to offer yet, we're not that far.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Carrie, go ahead.
I think that one thing I just want to bring up is that I think that using a common sense rule is a good rule, but I think that for some departments and things, it kind of needs to be discussed more. Mm-hmm. Being that I commute from Spencer, and so it's a pretty long commute, mm-hmm. and the roads aren't maintained very well once I get off the main road. Mm-hmm. Main roads have a priority, obviously. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people commute from Binghamton and some even from Syracuse. Mm-hmm. And from what I've been hearing as well is that using the common sense doesn't always work, meaning that some people, although they're not essential personnel, they're getting the message that unless the university is closed, you need to go out on the road and you need to be at your desk. Mm-hmm. Meaning that even if there's travel advisories through counties that you have to travel through to get onto campus, you still have to do that. And so that's a message that is perpetuated in some departments. And I don't know, I think communication will help just with supervisors, but I think that kind of needs to be unearthed and brought to the table as well. Because then there's resentment, why do I have to take my personal time if the road is closed or there's a travel advisory? What if my coworker can walk to work, but I can't? And I don't have any easy answers for that. I mean, I think that, the Office of Human Resources, Mary in particular, when I called in the last storm we had, Betsy answered the phone and said, don't come in. I mean, the message was very clear. But I think that in my own unit, there are different messages being given.
Mm-hmm.
The supervisors all made it in that day, and most lived very locally where the roads were easy to get into work. And then the staff under the supervisors are scattered very far off campus. And it was not easy to get in, and some didn't get in. Mm-hmm. And the message was not very supportive.
Uh-huh. For those that didn't make it in.
Right. Not for all, but I think, and I hear that from a lot of staff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and from, the communication when I read through that from what Tommy Bruce was given as feedback. So although I think that, Mary Offerman has been very supportive, I think that the poor needs to be then shared, and maybe, you know, discussion on key points for different units needs to be shared on. Like you said, who's essential? I don't want you traveling when the power lines are down and there's ice in, you know, your county. So maybe those things need to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what process the committee goes through for, yeah, I mean, first, you know, to define the essential personnel, that seems to me to be the first step, you know, and then somebody needs to review that list and say, why are these folks essential personnel, and do they really need to be here, you know, can we make this list shorter, whatever, you know, if you do have that kind of situation where you've got supervisors, managers, and whoever saying that, you know, all of my personnel is essential, everybody needs to be here. Sebastian, you
are
next.
none of our bosses made it in. I was the only worker, but I came in on the bus, so I wasn't worried about the bus, you know, getting dented. So that's something. What I wanted to know is, did anybody bring up the discussion of actually using technology? My wife and I both have computers. The only thing that I could not do from home would be to receive the checks and actually bring them to the bursar. And you know what? They can wait a day.
Mm-hmm.
We knew enough in it ahead of time that I could have either having access to the server,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I do the president's letter, or the dean's letters, not to the president, the dean's letters and things like that. Things that can be done, you know, I could do if I had access to our
mm-hmm.
our database. And there's a lot of people that are probably in the same boat.
Yeah, I did the
leave
same
them home.
I know.
If the server can support, there's the key right there.
Yeah.
If the server can support all of us dialing in, which I doubt, it would work, or, you know, maybe bring some work home with you to work
mm-hmm.
on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, really, on Friday, when I went, I'm like, okay, I know the storm is coming, and I packed up my stuff. And
it wasn't a big surprise. You know,
CIT is making a big initiative for Cornell University BGN. The servers should, it's definitely at the hotel script, should be able to handle it, whether it's set up or not.
Are they independent?
Each college would do that.
Yeah,
there are colleges
like that
you can work from home. I know CIS and Rose Hall can, one day a week, their employees take a day off to work from home, and they can get into all their business applications
mm-hmm.
and all their files.
I can't get into my home.
You're
right
just
now.
Set up.
See, I'm set up that way so that I can access my information.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in the discussion
yeah.
is worth pursuing.
Maybe push it in each unit to take capable of this.
Then it's time.
I think what I'm hearing from you and from the events of earlier this week at Virginia Tech is that there's a need to be able to communicate to people about a whole range of things, not just inclement weather. So whatever technology is put in place should be the kind that can be used under any circumstances.
Can I just add a little footnote there? Rich McDaniel, who you mentioned, is Vice President for Campus and Business Services. His purview, he has the safety, health, and environmental, risk management, SHRM. All of that is under him. So with having him on the committee is a really good thing
mm-hmm.
because any sort of emergency situation, anything like that, he would be involved. So, I mean, you make a good point. Yeah.
I actually, in case Leon was talking about where I live, no cell phone service.
Mm-hmm.
My phones also are ran by power. Your TV, the messages, and up there, Syracuse is closed, Cornell is closed, power could take that out, the phones, your computer. But like college radio station, everybody's car works. You know, if your power's out, turn on your car, you'll hear it. That's the way to hit everybody in every circumstance.
Well, everybody does not have a car, though. I know people that don't have cars.
So that would hit some of us.
Yeah, but like I think what Dennis said is correct. I mean, listen, if we can put a rover up on Mars, why can't we communicate down here on Earth with each other?
Quickly,
I mean, come on, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different ways. I'm saying there's many ways from A to Z to make it happen.
But that is another point. Those who don't have cars, maybe in a bus rider. I've been around enough that I let everybody know. I said, the buses aren't running, I won't be in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But some staff members aren't bold enough to say that in fear because there is talk.
Yeah,
they don't show
kind of
up.
Goes to what?
Because the laboratory goes on every day of the week.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, I think you get it that by defining your essential personnel. Wouldn't you think that that was?
But I think that's something the committee should look at as well. If they can define how your transportation. If the buses aren't running, that's a good indication that, well, maybe I can't make it.
Yeah.
And just so everyone knows, I mean, that was our first meeting, and basically it was a get to know you, this is what our goals are, this is what we'd like to accomplish. All of the information that I'm hearing right now, we've talked, we've said, we've done in that meeting. So we're going to go further. We're going to get some more information.
No.
I think this is very important. I want you all to know that all of these concerns will be addressed. We're not just going to brush it under the table. So definitely, I love hearing what you have to say, and I will bring this information back to the next meeting.
We trust you to do that.
Thanks for humoring
me. Yes.
I'm assuming that we call the meteorologists who are actually qualified to make the calls on these, or do we not? Because, I mean, it's for me, so yeah, this literally looks slippery out there, but, you know, as a layman, I don't know.
Yeah, Peggy,
some of those calls over the last few days, that there are about 15 people that are on a conference call at different decision points, and it includes pretty much the gamut, you know, Mary Opperman type. Ted Murray from EH&S, and there's this Mary Opperman type of
Sorry.
Cornell Police, Campus Life with the on-campus housing and dining program, and all these people are, I think that's one thing that's really come out, that the discussion seems to be a lot more broad, and so that's really good, and I think that in terms of closing, Mary.
We're not closing.
So that, you know, that's really good, because then all of those perspectives, I think, are brought to discussion. If you want to add anything to that, having just walked in.
Oh, you mean about those lovely
4 a.m. phone calls, 4 a.m. conference calls.
No, I think it's the start of a conversation inside of a broader conversation. You know, we've been for about a year talking about emergency planning as it relates to the pandemic, flu possibility. This is a pretty significant shift in the campus's position on inclement weather, and understanding what that really means for the organization is not. As much as people want to have things be simple and have good guys and bad guys and simple answers that smart people just ignore, it's very complicated in a residential institution with thousands of people dependent on our staff, with animals that need to be cared for and labs that have to run. There are students that risk decades of research work being lost if a pipe freezes, we have emergency personnel. When you talk about closing, it isn't actually that simple. It doesn't ever actually close. And so understanding what you can and cannot do within that context and what impact that has on people and positions is a lot, it's a lot more complicated, which is why in the past, and I'm not saying it's right, but I'm also not saying it's wrong, why in the past the position has been for a residential institution, if you don't feel like you can come in, don't risk your safety and take your time off. This executive vice president is willing to open a conversation that's more nuanced than that, but getting to a point where there's a different answer means hearing from lots of different groups and really understanding the impact. You know, a great, small, tiny example is that you can't actually say Cornell is closed without saying something about the animal hospital, because it doesn't close. And by not saying that when we closed early, we had people panicking because their pets were at our hospital.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any idea what that meant. People whose pets were scheduled for surgery, they didn't know if that meant they weren't going to have them. That's just
you know, one example. Graduate students who are saying, "I, you know, should I try to come back from wherever I am? You know, I took a couple days off and I have a decade of research, and if you're closing, does that mean my research is going to go down the tank?" So that's what I'm trying to say. No, it's harder than it seems.
Mary, I know you're going to try to take a bite of your pizza and I'm going to ask you. Go ahead and bite. All right. And I'll give you enough.
Now I'm supposed to talk, and I'll get time to chew.
We were discussing earlier about the process, about how essential personnel might be defined. And I just wondered if you had a sense of how that would happen. I mean, it has to be specifically defined, but is there going to be some oversight of who's on that list and who's
essential functions, do you mean?
Well, it's essential functions. That's one thing we tried to, in our meeting, we tried to separate essential personnel from the function. And that, mm-hmm. that is one thing. They want to know who those people are that are going to come in and do that essential function.
Can you help us understand how that might be put together, or do you not have a sense of that yet?
Well, it's not, you know, there's two ways to go with this. We've been looking at other people's essential personnel plans and things.
Uh-huh.
There are places that have like 9 levels of essential staffing. If you've ever looked along the sprawl, big high school, big school district, has, refer to plan number 8. Under plan 8, it says this is the mode we're in, and these are the people, these are the functions considered essential. Plan 1, these are the people considered essential. Plan 2, and it, you know, goes from, you know, very few people reporting in the most serious of circumstances up to essentially everybody but the students, right, or something along those lines. And so we can try to be very precise. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to, and I think probably a way that will work better, you know, at Cornell, is to describe those areas that run no matter what and ask each of those areas in the context of their emergency planning to develop plans for reduced staffing. Because it could be inclement weather, it could be illness. There are a number of types of emergencies that could cause an organization to be reduced staff. So I think we're thinking along those lines. And a good example that's used is the payroll office. If it's a day off of a payroll cycle, you can close. And the concept here, of course, is that you're asking people not to come in because it's safer if they don't. So that would be a group that you would say, do everyone a favor and stay home, right? It's a bad day, except if it's a payroll day, in which case you all have this funny need to get paid. Understand it personally. You know, open enrollment periods, make the benefits office essential. I mean, there's other, you know, so coming to some precise thing at a place this big and complicated isn't probably going to happen. But say to the hospital, all right, develop a plan for when realistically everyone is not going to come in. Do you know who can come in? Do you have a way of netting out that essential work and that's fair for your organization? I think that's probably the way we'll go. Mm-hmm. There won't be like a cookbook, but rather going through and trying to give the leaders of the organization the way to determine how to staff the essential operations when they are in fact essential.
And Mary, where will that advice or that guidance come from to help chairs or deans or whomever we need to deal with?
Well, that's what our committee is supposed to talk about.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions?
Okay. You know, we thought we had a year, right?
Yeah. And some of the thoughts that I heard, especially from Carrie, it seems like the staff that kind of weren't essential were kind of the ones who were underneath the supervisors who had a hard time coming in. It seemed like they seemed upset that they would have to use like their vacation time or personal time. It seems like perhaps that might be better redefined, like 6 days/snow days, just so that they have an idea that.
Well, remember that people here get 3 personal days. And those come out of the sick bank, right, if you use them. those days are for, they're defined as being for inclement weather or other personal reasons.
I think some people just lose track of that. I mean, I know I see my all my days and I say, oh, wow, this is great. These are my days. And I better save it for my child if she gets sick or this or that. And I don't really think too much about snow days, but I live in town, so if I had to, I could walk here.
Right.
But
that's the whole point of not being so prescriptive. So for you, you would rather use those days for other reasons than walk up to campus if you can do that. So if we have days that are very segmented out and not interchangeable, over time what ends up happening is someone who never uses those snow days begins to see them in the same way that the personal days are beginning. Well, it's not really fair. How come some people get, you know, two inclement weather days just because I live in Ithaca? You know, that's where it's very hard to address that concern that people don't feel they should have to use their own time off when the weather is bad. Because I don't know what to do with that point. I really don't. Mm-hmm. That we should pay everybody to stay home except the people that we require to come in. Well, I can see that once every 4 or 5 years the weather will be bad enough that you can come up with a moment where it really is better for everyone if only the very necessary people come in, they get paid their premium pay, everyone else is paid to stay home. What about the 2 or 3 or 4 times every year that doesn't rise to that level where you have legitimate differences? I don't like driving in the snow. So I feel unsafe as soon as there's any slush on the road. Is that a personal choice? I have a small car. You have an SUV. Should you have to come in and be paid the same amount that I get paid to stay home? It's a lot harder to make this perfect than you know, it's in the absolute, it's a blizzard, everyone go home, and those of you who have to keep the roads, you get premium pay. Okay. But there's, most of the weather doesn't fall in there. It falls somewhere between it's sunny and it's a blizzard. And in those times, there is no way to make that fair, other than to say to people, it's a personal choice, and it's fine that you make it. Mm-hmm. And that's why we give you those days.
I think that's the message that needs to get out there, and I think it comes from, so what I had said when you weren't here is when I call your office, the message that's given. That's not always the message that is given from direct supervisors. And somehow I think that has to change.
Yeah, there's definitely a management issue here, a leadership issue that we need to address about what people say to folks who don't come in for personal reasons. It's mm-hmm. not just about this, by the way. It's also, speaking of other emergencies, about the pandemic.
Right.
How many people do you know who feel guilty if they don't come in when they're sick? Right? They drag themselves in here with a contagious disease because somebody in their organization doesn't feel comfortable if they don't. That's worse. Not a whole lot of people I know. Well, that's not true because I'm one of those people. Sometimes I am one of those people that I just am so doggone competitive. I can't admit that I'm too sick to stay home. I come in and sneeze on everybody. But there are a lot of people who would stay home and do the right thing and take care of themselves, but they feel that the message that's coming from their leadership is that they can't.
Right.
So it's about personal safety. It's about health.
I mean, specifically, so, you know, for people who commute a lot, I think it contradicts when you have on the TV they're saying no unnecessary travel, no advice, or just things like that. And then you get, okay, I'm not an essential personnel. They're telling you no unnecessary travel, but the university's not closed. So there's, you know, so obviously I need to come in. You know, and then when you get to work and the supervisor says, you're either getting one or two messages. You're getting, well, you shouldn't have come in. The roads are horrible out there. Or you're getting, well, I made it in.
So obviously you should have made it in too.
Well, or I can't make it in, so you better make it in.
Right.
So a lot of people had their notes. There wasn't a single faculty member or supervisor around, but the staff felt they had to come in because there was nobody there. These are management issues. There will never come a day when a policy or a rule can replace good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't happen. So getting managers to think in a stewardship way and communicate, God help us all, in a reasonable way. You know, when you know the weather is going to be bad the next day, how hard is it to really say, okay, let's figure out our plan. Who can come in without a lot of hassle? Who has some work they can do at home? And, you know, who is just going to take the day and stay home and, you know, take a personal day? And that's what we do. It's really not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know you need a certain number of people to answer the phone. You know your work is going to probably be reduced because a lot of people aren't there. You spend 15 minutes talking to folks. You come up with your skeletal staffing plan, and that's it. Somebody says, listen, I worked at home last time. I'll find my way in. It's fine. I can get a ride or I'll take the bus. And he says, oh, thanks, and I think I'm going to work at home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean, you know, it's not rocket science.
Mm-hmm.
It's just regular old communication and planning. It's pretty simple, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You get caught off guard or it happens over the weekend, that's a little harder to do.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that we have to get out to ask people.
Mm-hmm.
One comment that I'd just like to make that maybe Pat can bring forward to that group is in talking about, you know, the what the radio or the TV, and they start to say no unnecessary
mm-hmm.
travel. I think for as many people in the room, we could interpret that differently.
Right.
And how, you know, one may view it as unnecessary travel might be, gee, I think I'll go shopping today,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to work is necessary travel, and therefore that doesn't include me. And so there's an interpretation of what you're hearing. And I don't know if that can be talked about in terms of a communication issue that we need to think about relative to inclement weather, because that's certainly a message that's out there.
You know, Steve actually wants to do that. He wants to try to give some general guidance if you hear travel advisory.
Yeah,
versus the roads are closed versus
mm-hmm.
state of emergency. So he brought that up.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, again, when we talk about the essential function, if you read that document, that actual document that's in the policy, that document is what you take in the car with you and show to a police officer if you are on a road that is not allowed to be traveled on. So that is, I think, a helpful piece for all of this as well. So, but yeah, I'd be happy to bring that back to the next meeting.
Well, I'm wondering, when the policy finally does get developed and rolled out, it does sound like there needs to be some training or something for supervisors and managers to implement it properly. So, I mean, maybe that's something that the employee assembly can help with in the future.
It's really, certainly trained them on the words. That's not the problem. We've been all over this campus training supervisors. We trained 2,000 supervisors over the last however long about using your head and
mm-hmm.
planning and communicating and treating people with respect. And I mean, that's the essential core of the supervisory development program. You know, we can take this as another example. I firmly believe we are talking about a very small percentage of this organization that has tyrants over top of the organization who are just mean-spirited and could care less. Most of this is caused by a lack of planning and communication. They don't know what to, and it comes from above the people that aren't saying anything, because they don't know what to say. So I think that what we have to do is once the policy comes out, and it'll all be in the context of emergency planning, I think we'll
mm-hmm.
frame our conversations to the deans, to the vice presidents, and hold them accountable for getting these messages down.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the time ever comes where we actually do have a pandemic, these are the very same essential management skills you have to get yourself through a pandemic. Because if the pandemic occurs, it is highly unlikely that Cornell can close, because because if a pandemic occurs, it's occurring across the whole country, they will shut the transportation systems down, and that will lock a large percentage of our students here. Now, to mention the fact that if there is a pandemic in this country, the international students are not going to be allowed to leave, which means that by virtue of those things that will happen, the campus can't close at the very same time that people are getting sick, people and their family are getting sick. So it's like this issue, you know, magnified. So you have to have start with something small. There's a snowstorm. Talk to people. Because all of these issues, who is essential, what skills do they have, how do they get in, what do you do when someone's sick, all these issues are going to just explode if we ever come up to a pandemic. So the skill set and the training it's got to be in the context of a broader context of emergency planning, and that's what Rich McDaniel and his group, I think, are trying to do, is frame it and then get the vice presidents and deans to really embrace it.
Mary, I know your time is kind of limited today. How about
you? Should I talk about the vigil?
How much longer do we have you?
I don't know. I've been about a half hour late all day. So, I just want to be sure that everyone here knows that tomorrow at 12:30, we're going to do a remembrance program in Sage Chapel. Giving people an opportunity to reflect on the tragedy at Virginia Tech. Many of us know people at Virginia Tech. It's been very sobering. What happened there could happen anywhere. And people are integrating this information differently, you know, based on, gee, what would I have done? You know, that could have been me, that could have been my child, that could have happened at Cornell. Some people are just experiencing, not just, people are experiencing profound sadness over the loss and tragedy for all those young people and their families. And so this is an opportunity for the community to come together. I'm sending out a note through the HR community encouraging supervisors to permit those who want to come and have that experience to be able to do so. It's kind of over the lunch hour, so hopefully it won't be too difficult. Is being streamed. So some people who don't really want to be in a public setting and have that experience can stay in their offices. We were kind of imagining that for some folks who for whom this would be either far away or they could maybe get together and watch it. So I just want to encourage everybody who thinks that, you know, having that experience will be somewhat healing to come and to encourage people to go. It's not just for the students, it's for the whole community.
So there was an email that went out yesterday from Tuscan Support, and I trust you all got it yesterday. All right. Mary, did you have anything else for us?
No.
Okay. Because we wanted to talk with you about, Hazel and I had discussed with you about the mortgage benefit program. I thought that that might be a good topic to discuss. I think it would be really helpful for the EA to know what you first had crafted back in 2003 and just a little bit of background and history.
Although Steve Golding and the committee he has and I have come kind of around to a more nuanced kind of set of ideas, but I can tell you sort of in a general way, we had been working with the neighborhood housing, try to come up with some programs that would assist staff in buying homes, multifamily homes in closer in College Town area, downtown area, where students are the tenants. The idea comes from my experience at Harvard, where if you have areas that you were trying to renew, Patton did a fantastic job in this, and so did Yale. They helped make affordable home buying near the campus so that staff would be able to move in and own in communities that were undergoing significant renewal, allowing for people who would otherwise not be able to live in Philadelphia, for example, to live there now. lived in very rough neighborhoods until they were completely turned over, but people took that chance. It was an opportunity. In Penn, they walked to work. You're talking about a pretty big city, so folks gave up hour and a half commute, walked to work. Some of them lived for a decade in pretty tough neighborhoods until it got renewed. New Haven did it as part of the renewal. So I came up with this idea very innocently during one of those periods where everyone was mad because the students were peeing on their gardenias. Remember we had a period of time where the students were like out of control downtown and the
wild.
You remember that? And
well,
it was a senior week and it got really bad, and then the freshman the next year the orientation week was really bad, and everybody was all Twitter-pated downtown about the students misbehaving. So it kind of came during that period of time, and that's sort of settled down now. But I was thinking if you could merge these two concerns, mine that too many staff who would choose differently live too far away because they can't afford to live here, with the idea that students, anyone, behaves differently if their landlord lives next to them than they do if they're in an absentee landlord circumstance. I was thinking that if we could make home buying more affordable, you could get more staff to come in, because if you live in a multifamily home, once you buy it, then you have the rent income. It makes that home that you would otherwise not be able to afford much more affordable, but a lot of people get stuck on the down payment. So that was the idea I had. It didn't go anywhere because it was really expensive, and it was at a time when I was also advocating for the child care grant, and to be honest with you, for those who hate this decision, I'm sorry, but I had to pick, and so I picked the child care grant because even though I don't like to see people live far away, it makes me really nervous that too many children were in unlicensed care, so I picked them. When Steve came, we started looking at issues of sustainability and the idea of the campus master plan, and the whole issue of housing and affordable housing was coming back up in the community. So we've been talking again about the idea of kind of having different mortgage support programs. The outer tier mortgage program is really just a volume discount program. Princeton has it, and it doesn't cost the university very much to buy a contract for it. I say that, and it's like hundreds of thousands of dollars. Anyway, theoretically, in the scheme of things, it doesn't cost that much. And then by doing that, you basically, the university covers the closing costs, or a lot of the closing costs, the points and things like that, through this volume program. And so if you look at that as sort of the baseline HR benefit, then we're starting to talk now about what other things could we do to get people to move into the bus line. Is there a way we could encourage people to move, make it affordable for them to move so they could live on a bus line so they wouldn't need to bring their car up onto the campus? And then we were also talking about this idea about getting folks who wanted to own multifamily homes and rent to students. So it's all very early.
Mm-hmm. I just want to do this with people to hear and take it this stuff. Anybody? Comment? Ideas? Suggestions? Sound like a good idea or a bad idea? Give me something.
I think the bus line thing is important.
I think it would be fantastic, and if the net result of it was that the community was more heavily populated with Cornell staff, that would be such a huge issue from a town gown perspective, because the staff are the more consistent people on the campus. They don't leave every 4 years, and I think it would be a really positive thing all the way around. Now, a lot of people don't want to live here. And so it's not like, I don't personally think that you're going to have a floodgate of folks who are leaving their extended families but some do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really worried about excess demand. I mean, I think some percentage might want.
Yeah, I actually would take advantage of that. I'm renting right now, and I'm thinking about moving further away because it's less expensive.
Because of the house prices.
Yeah.
And the taxes.
They're double, 45 minutes away. Mm-hmm. They're
Yep, I agree.
So
we're also looking at some housing development, where I was probably not going to happen in time to move, but we're also looking at, as we look at the 10-year campus plan,
we're also looking at the possibility of putting up, or at least supporting developers in putting up what I would call reasonably priced homes. But that'll be, you know, the problem with that is we have developers that want to develop them. It's that the towns don't want to give them the variances to build townhomes. Because townhomes balloon your population. Most of these communities are saturated in their school districts and other resources, sewer and water and stuff. So they would rather have individuals building these humongoid houses that I don't know who buys those things. You know, these like monstrosities, because they don't, you don't bring in as much population. You get much more per square inch in tax, and you don't tax your resources as much. You know, there's a lot of developers that know that if they could put townhomes in, which are not the way people around here live, but, and I lived south of Boston, and they were very popular. You know, they stand on their own, they have their own front door, they have a garage. They're nice intermediate steps before you take the, you know, the plunge into having all of the headaches related to a single family.
Yeah, and you know, Mary, I'm thinking about townhouses and stuff. I mean, I'm not sure why there hasn't been a development like that.
Because
I mean,
the towns keep stopping them.
But I mean, having come from real estate development, I mean, that's my background. And kind of listening to the graduate students and their proposal for a residential initiative, it seems to me, with the new faculty hires that we have, the graduate student population, the staff on campus who want that kind of, like Brian, this is a good example, you know, kind of transition from the renting to the buying phase, that they would be a really good option.
So I agree, but the towns resist them because they tax your resources so much. And because the roads and the sewers, or lack of sewers, and the schools are maxed out in the outlying communities, Trumansburg, Lansing, you know, whatever, Brookendale, those areas, they tinker with their zoning so you can't get them in. So which means the developers have to go in and get them to change the zoning. And in many cases, they're zoned agricultural. So they, I mean, look around, what's still left? It's old, unused farmland now. These farmers or their families are trying to sell them. You know, so they don't want it. They're not farming it anymore. They don't want it. The towns just, they don't feel like they can handle the resources that they need. So that's the block, is what happens. And, you know, Cornell has to be careful here because we own a lot of land. If we build on it, then we take those builder out of the tax rolls, and then all of these problems just get worse than the tax rolls go up, because now you got a whole bunch of people living on these things, nobody's paying tax, blah, blah, blah. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I just, Mary, being from Geneva and not on the campus, how would this type of a program apply to the outliers, like Wheel or, you know, Staff at Wheel or Geneva, or we have Fredonia and Hudson Valley as well?
Well, Wheel would have a totally different program.
Okay.
Because it wouldn't work for them.
But how about, like, Geneva and our, even Geneva satellite?
The home buyer, if you do a home buyer program that helps with the closing, I mean, more of a volume kind of a program, that could be, you pay by the drink, so you pay one of these companies that
not open bar.
Why at 4 in the morning, I'm fine if I didn't go to sleep. So you do it by the number of people. So you'd add the number of people in Geneva into it, and because it's done through these national bank programs.
Okay. Mary, is this being targeted for staff only, or staff and graduate students?
And those programs are usually open.
Okay. So for anyone in the community.
But I want to caution you, this is not simple. It's not simple, because now just listen to what I just said. The way Princeton got it in, it's done through Chase. How do our local banks stay vibrant? What is the biggest thing? Our local banks hold their mortgage
money.
And that lending is very important to their financial health.
That's true.
You're going to take that whole program, move it over to a national banking program, or you're going to sell it through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or, you know, I mean,
So the concept is easy, but when you live inside of a town that is totally reliant on you as a source of revenue, you have to think about them differently. So we have a ways to go in terms of these programs. We've talked to Tompkins Trust a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Was there a receptivity there?
Oh, you pay for something. Huh? Yeah. So we're getting there. It's a slow program, and it does have a significant startup cost at a time when the university is, you know, a little bit stretched in resources, so a little bit.
So, the group that's looking at this right now is
just HR.
Yeah.
The bigger one that's happening through Steve Golding has a real estate committee that looks at it in the broader context of our planning.
Mm-hmm.
It's only one of a number of features of the, you know, it's not really a feature of the master plan, but it's a feature of the outgrowth of the master plan. So that's a longer thing. But just the home buyer discount program itself is something that HR does. And we'll let you know what we find out. It's going to take money out of the money that we need to find to get it is in the fringe pool. Do you really want to know these job numbers? In order to be able to find the money in the fringe pool, we're trying to recalibrate our health programs, which are out of control. That's just out of control. And there's two areas that we're looking at. One of them is in our plan design and offering some plans that we think might be able to stem some of our costs. The other, candidly, is in the area of post-retirement health care. You know, with the introduction of Medicare Part B, our prescription drug program now is redundant to Medicare Part D. Federal government, being the federal government, promised employers who kept their prescription drug plan that they would reimburse us for our costs. Here's the surprise. They've reimbursed us a fraction of what the program is actually costing. And so we just had the analysis done. We're losing millions of dollars every year by keeping our program. Same time, very worried about Medicare Part D because I don't have confidence they're going to be able to sustain Medicare Part D. And I'm petrified about the idea of all of our older folks losing their prescription drug program. We're trying to find places in our health program, which is the program we have no control over, and it has been the principal reason why we haven't been able to put more money into direct pay, because every year we give a SIP, you know, we have a set amount of money. Some of it has to go to fund the benefits programs, and some of it goes to pay. It's a standard total comp strategy. We can't get out down under double digits in the benefits pool, and it keeps siphoning out of our total available funds. And that's the pool, that $100 million fringe pool, is the pool in which a program like the Home Buyers Program would get embedded. And so what I need to be able to do is come up with some cost-saving strategies. And we have some great things that Paul can come and talk with, Paul Bursa can come and talk to you about a couple of new programs that we're hoping to put together that will, we believe, over time, moderate our increases to new health plans, not instead of the plans we have, but in addition, that we think people will be very interested in. One of them really focused on wellness, and so much more money towards preventative care with the emphasis on health and wellness, and with the idea that over time will stem the tide, because our costs are going up, not in medical claims, but in prescription drugs. And so that's where our double-digit increases just continue unabated, and people are scripting themselves silly here. And definitional trend, it's not Cornell specific. You know, with many prescription drugs being prescribed that could potentially be moderated if people took better care of themselves. High numbers of antidepressants and anti-anxiety. We know from the research that if you're physically active, you can sometimes moderate your need for those drugs. Large numbers of cholesterol drugs, blood pressure medications, heart medications, all related to diet and exercise. So we're looking at the potential of offering a plan that front loads more financial support on staying healthy, with the idea that over time, if people stayed in that program and took that program seriously, it would moderate some of our other stuff. I told you, it's all connected.
It is.
It's, all, it's like a fine Waldo. You know, where's the money?
All right. Does anybody else have questions for Mary?
If you have ideas on what would be important to you in a home buyer's program, I'd love to just send me a note. Please don't go out and promulgate that as a given, because like I said, it's more complicated than it needs to be, but, you know, Donna asked, where are we thinking next in terms of benefits, and that's the next benefit. We've done a yeoman's job, I think, in some of things, and not at all in others, and home buying is something we haven't touched.
Quick question. I have a quick one for you, Mary. One of our things that we deal with in Geneva is we have a heating plant that is a 24/7 operation, mm-hmm. and they have to work over the holiday, the winter break. Mm-hmm. I got a call from a few of our guys asking me regarding comp time, because they would earn comp time during that period. Is there any way that comp time can be taken beyond June 30th? And they're wondering if the reason is no because of the fiscal year end and the funding for that, is there some other way that it can be done? Because sometimes...
Are these exempts you're giving comp time to?
Not exempt.
No, it really is, because you're supposed to... The Fair Labor Standards Act controls overtime and premium pay.
Right.
So the concept is really that you need to true up with them in a reasonable amount of time. Now, you've given them their overtime, you're talking
Absolutely.
About the additional days.
Right, right.
You know, what I would suggest is that you work with them in terms of their overall time bank and have them use those first and work on their vacation second or mm-hmm. something. I'm just really loath to do that, even though I know why they're asking and why you're asking. It is a short jump to people never getting to take their days. You know, so that's not why you want to know, and that's not why they want to know. But if you don't put pressure on people to force them to use that comp time, it goes into the same bank that the vacation does, and it doesn't get used. And then before you know it, they've essentially worked for less than we owe them. That's why. Not because I'm trying to be bullheaded about it, but because there needs to be a discipline. They didn't get those days off. They need days off instead. So...
Okay, that's good. I'll share that with you.
That's my new mantra. Take time off. You know, I hate to tell you, but the place will still be here when you come in.
Okay.
Does everybody have their vacation schedules for the summer done?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
By September.
Have you got yours all planned? Okay, there's no point here.
pointing fingers
to those who say do as I say, not as I say. No, they don't. I'm awful at this. And I am and everyone in my office who knows me listens to me proselytize about this and then just snickers at me the entire way back because I'm the worst. I know this, and I can't stand the idea of something happening while I'm there. I know that. The rest of you need to take this.
Alright, thanks. Alright, so let's see, we can move into committee reports. Yeah, let's postpone it. Hazel's not here, and I'd rather... And it's not really sabbatic leave. It's staff renewal.
Yeah.
It's not sabbatic leave. If this is something that came out of the Chili Chat discussion slash recommendation, We heard it a couple of different ways and a couple of different times about staff being able to take a break and go do something completely different from what their job description was. You know, go volunteer somewhere or go do some other job someplace and then come back to the job that they had. What? Why are you laughing?
No.
So they actually learn it or shadow it? But they can
either. I mean, you know, take somebody who works, I don't know, in the vet college doing a particular job in the lab. They could go to Duke and go see what they're doing, and it's like an internship, like that kind of thing.
We're talking about physically leaving Cornell.
Yeah. Or, you know, Guatemala, or, you know, wherever. Wherever the interest might take them. And the idea is someone else would fill in for you while you were doing that. They would get to learn about your job and keep everything going while you're gone for 3 months or however long you're gone, and then when you come back, you've got that job, they go back to their job with a whole new learning, and everybody learns new stuff. And
so the person that would take your job would be a Cornell employee.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about, I know at one time we talked about these rotating staff that we would hire to do this type of thing. Is that what we're talking about, or someone within your own department?
I think that it would be just a cross-training opportunity, and you could do it, probably the easiest just to do it within your department. I mean, if I, say it was me, and I wanted to go to Cutter, to go see what they do, you know, whatever.
Ooh.
Yeah, I don't know. And so I would say to my supervisor, this is something that I would really like to do. I've, you know, sent email to so-and-so, and they would like to have me come, and I can learn things over there, and it would be great. And then he would say, okay, well, we need to get your job done while you're gone. So, you know, Susie over here is an administrative assistant, and this is something that I know she would like to learn how to do. So we'll have her fill your shoes while you're away, and when you come back, then you'll have your job, and she'll go back to hers. And that kind of thing.
And who would pay you?
Cornell? Yeah. I mean, when it's like the patient, like when faculty do it, you know, there's that opportunity. I mean, we have internship programs for students that do the same thing, essentially.
Yeah, you know, I'm not against this idea, but there are differences between faculty contracts and what their expectations are, with their performance and taking sabbaticals off to write books and publish and do whatever they do and whatever. But so I guess the only thing I'm saying is not identical to what staff would do, with what faculty would do.
Oh, no, and not at all. Yeah. It's just, you know, kind of in awe. I mean, that's what we heard from Chili Tech.
It sounds like a wonderful idea. You know, I don't know how it would affect us.
Yeah, then I think, too, like some of our units are already understaffed, overworked, and all of this kind of stuff, and who's going to train the person and whatever. But once again, I don't want to throw cold water or anything, because I think it's something we should consider and look into.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an opportunity there. We, you know, there are a lot of things going around at the university that faculty and students, all kinds of opportunities that they have that staff don't have. And, you know, there are international opportunities. We have, the late Chase is not here. David Whitman, who's the Vice Provost for International Relations, came to our leadership breakfast and talked to us about opportunities that they were looking at in Africa and China and all that. I mean, you don't have to have a PhD to go have an opportunity there. You could be, you know, an engineer. You could be a project manager. You could be a project coordinator. You could be a secretary. I mean, I think that there are opportunities for staff who want to do something different. So that's what that was about. So, yeah, I mean, kind of like Mary said about the mortgage program, there are all sorts of things to work out about it, but it's the concept. You know, and just first getting the discussion rolling. I mean, when I talked to a couple of people about this, my boss included, you know, he said, well, I would backfill your position if you wanted to go do something for 6 months or whatever. What? Yes. Okay. It's 1:30. So do we want to extend the meeting or do we want to just close?
We don't have 1:45 there's a meeting, so we have till then.
Okay. So that's the concept for the staff renewal, not sabbatical week. So it's just something that food for thought. Committee reports. Do we have any committee reports?
We're there.
Okay, that's all right. I just wanted to say that in front of everybody
yeah.
so they knew that you hadn't
done it yet. I haven't. The
resolution will be done by next meeting.
Okay.
For
us
to vote on and send forward.
All right, Chuck.
Tom? We're working on the handout for new staff work for now. As far as trying to plan the other, you want to show them?
Yeah, I've got a couple of them. It's very, very rough draft, but you guys can check it out and see kind of like the format. Obviously, the stuff inside, I wrote mostly about committees and how you can get involved, what it is the EA can do, stuff that I gather kind of off the website. But
and you could start to go in the new employee packet, right?
Or to go, I thought we were sending it like 6 months later, but the employee packets that we were sending, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I just had a question about the resolution on the campus code.
Can
we keep it? As I understand, the president is waiting just on the employee assembly resolution to act now.
Yeah, I thought we were okay with that after the last meeting. Did I miss something?
I thought it was
not on the agenda, so
discussion.
I think we made a few changes and it was
I thought so too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean sent back for us to review.
Oh.
Through email.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry because I thought that
but
we were.
But I probably only sent it to Hazel.
Oh. Mm-hmm. All right. I thought we were done.
I wonder if maybe there's a way that that could be approved by email because
at this point.
Yeah, she can send it again.
We don't have to hold up the president's response. Of course. Yeah, and I'm sorry because I was under a different impression. I thought that we had, yeah, I did. I thought we had talked about the changes and that we were all set.
Mm-hmm. I think they were in concept rather than in concrete language.
All right.
There was just like agreement about how much time to wait before approving it or having objections raised just because now that the faculty senate has also passed its resolution, it really is all on the UA, and I know the EA, and I know that a lot of people are waiting for the.
Yeah, cool. Well, great. And I don't mean to keep people waiting because I thought I was done. So yeah, if you can send it to us all, and then we'll just all reply all so that we know that there's buy-in. Okay, great. Anybody else with a committee report or any other business? Okay, so hearing none, can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay, meeting adjourned. Thanks, everyone.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.